Before we jump into the podcast, a special announcement. My new book, Win the Inside Game, is almost here. It comes out in a few days, but you can order it right now. What is this book about? It's all about fulfilling your potential. I go over the science and psychology of coming through in the clutch, of choking, of underperformance, of getting in our own way, of pressure, performance anxiety, of why we don't have courage when it matters most. So if you have an athlete, or perhaps yourself, who's struggling with the mental side, this book redefines how to strive and gives you the tools and mindsets to be able to come through under pressure. But it's not just that. It also goes through in details for the first time, from my viewpoint, my experience whistleblowing. Why? Because that was 10 years of pressure, anxiety, of sometimes coming through in the clutch and being courageous, and other times wilting. So if you want to hear my experience from the FBI knocking on my car door to, you know, the moments when I was stuck in a hallway in Nike trying to figure out what to do, I cover it all as well. So if you haven't yet, check it out. You won't regret it. And as a super special deal for listeners of the On Coaching Podcast, if you order now before launch week is over, guess what? You get all sorts of bonuses. I'm giving away a 120-page ebook coaching book that I wrote called The Elements of Coaching, but I have never released it. Why? It was to guide my own personal coaching journey. I wrote it for myself to help me, but I decided, screw it. Let's help people. I'm going to give that away if you order the book. So two new books for the price of one. You're also going to get a 40-hour course and masterclass on the mental side of performance, plus some behind-the-scenes videos I've done on, you know, training for high-level athletes. So you're going to see all that as well. And a lot of other good stuff. So if you want to get those bonuses, you can see the link in the show notes or head on over to stevemagnus.com. You'll see a link to buy the book and get the bonuses. Buy Win the Inside Game. It's available Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever you can get books. And it means a lot and it matters a lot if you order early or pre-order. It makes a huge difference. Thank you for listening. Let's get to the show. I hope you read the book. And if you do, please tell me what you think. Thanks, everybody. And welcome back, or welcome to another episode of the On Coaching Podcast. I'm Steve Magnus, joined as always by my good friend and colleague, John Marcus. John, what's going on, my man?
Oh, you know, I just stepped outside. Beautiful winter day here in Portland, Oregon. Got some fresh air, and I'm with my cup of coffee, ready to give the people what they want. Let's go.
All caffeined up. That's the key here.
That's the secret. That's the secret.
That is the hack. Get the caffeine. Everything else flows from it. So this week we've got another interesting one. I think it's the key to basically life. Everything.
Yes. You're not wrong, sir.
No, it is.
And it's consistency wins. How to do it in the face of volatility and unpredictability. And I'm gonna tell you, we're gonna talk about running, but as I said, this applies to everything. If you want to write a book, guess what you got to do?
Figure out how to be consistent and show up when everything is pulling you towards not showing up and not being consistent, because it's a lot more engaging to pull out your phone and scroll on whatever social media you got, right? And it's the same when it comes to running. And I think the reason we're going to talk about this is because increasingly, and the world that we live in, it's harder to show up consistently because we have more distractions. We have more options. We have, I would say, a higher bar of comparison that sometimes gets in our way, right? And all of these things, there's more unpredictability in the world. All of these things like pull us towards being like, you know, as long as I good enough, I'll be all right. But the reality is, if you want to explore your potential, if you want to see how good you're going to be, consistency is king. And you better
figure out how to show up basically every day.
And there's also like an impatience element to it too, right? Like we want accelerative gains. We want it now. Like we are living in a dopamine supercharged, world. And also too, the zeitgeist is that it's like click, swipe, rapid. Oh, I'm not seeing results. I'm working hard. And it's been interesting coaching a lot of young freshmen, you know, in developing a Division I program from scratch, right? With just youth is that a theme I keep hearing is I'm working really hard. I'm not seeing results. And it's, you know, the air of impatience of youth of saying, well, you know, working hard for a couple weeks or a couple months, especially in a really difficult sport that is blunt and honest, like track and field or, you know, cross country, the idea that you're going to see instant gains like you did in high school when you get to college or even at later chapters of your life in anything isn't always 2 feet in reality.
I think that's a good point because I think it's harder to have delayed gratification now. Because the culture is essentially, I want my improvement now. I want my performance gains. I want to see the payoff for the work that I'm doing now.
Yeah.
Why? You know, partially because like you look around and you think like, oh, everyone's getting their gains. Like, where are mine? And even in track and field, like we see this, how it's evolved. Like people run crazy fast at meets in December, January, February, March, April, May, June, July. Like basically every month of the year almost, there's someone doing something nuts and you're just like, wait a minute. Well, back in our day, it was essentially cross country. Then you got to wait a couple months because like people do okay indoors, but no one lit the world on fire. And then you'd have to wait till we're outdoors. There were like two periods of times where you ran fast and one, the time didn't even matter because you were just running around cross country courses. Now that's not the case. And I think what that does is it puts this impetus on like, I want my results too. But if you look back throughout history, the genius of Arthur Lydiard, and we talk about him a lot, but for a good reason, everybody does. But the genius of Lydiard was, you know, not the, you know, 100 miles a week or what have you. The genius of him was saying, hey, guys, for the next like many months,
yeah. Half a year, you're just going to hunker down. Yes.
Just like hunker down and train a lot. Mm-hmm. Like this was the genius because he came out of the kind of amateur era of Bannister in the 50s, who essentially, yeah, they trained, but it was more of like, okay, we're getting closer. And then if you look at Fran Stanfill's training, who influenced Bannister and coached Bannister to agree, like it was like, okay, you know, we're a couple months out. We're going to start our 400 meter progression of going from 68 to 66 to 64 and get down to 60. And in 3 months, we'll be good. Lydiard essentially said, whoa, wait a minute. Delayed gratification, people. 6 months, train. And then we'll start to use that with our hills and our intervals and our faster work. Then we'll start to exploit that. But you've got to have this delayed gratification. It reminds me of when I was in college, my college coach who ran professional for a while, when I was at Houston, she was a low 2 minute 800 runner. She said that, when she was in college, she went to that coach who was very good and said, hey, I want to make a big jump. Like, what do I do? And the college coach looks her in the eyes after the track season and says, you know, essentially, I forget the exact mileage, but it was like, go run 70 miles a week with strides 3 days a week for 3 months. And then we'll get to work after that. And the point was like, we've got to put in the work and get consistent at doing so before we can reap those rewards. And I think nowadays what happens is we want to, yeah, put in the work, but we want to reap the rewards instantly or close to it. And what happens is we get in our own way because of that.
Yeah, we've lost the, target on impactful change versus just change. And when I was in high school, like thankfully, my head coach in track and soccer, who's the same person, communicated to me really effectively my freshman year of like, when you get better is when we don't see you, is the summer and the winter. So during summer break and during winter break, that's when you can get better. When we see you, right, during the fall or during the spring, in season, that's when you just express and we just like essentially put icing on the cake. But baking the cake, putting in the oven, getting all the ingredients, like doing everything, that's on you in the summer and the winter. And that alone really was a catalyst for me in a lot of ways, because it gave me a discrete period of time to say, okay, I got to push myself, train, do this, be on the grind, what have you, to elevate myself or to raise my base, as Lydia would call it, to a position that would allow me to ascend to a higher peak. And I think we have forgotten that in this day of like show and tell media, where it's just like, cool, I can like show these like stupid human tricks that are happening, or this really impressive like one-off workout or what have you, right? But impactful change is a key ingredient of consistency. And the other key ingredient that, you know, is the corollary to this is adaptability, right? A lot of times we think that being consistent means I just got to show up, punch the clock no matter what, and grit my teeth and grind through it. But adaptability is the heart of consistency. So it's finding workarounds and finding ways to continue on the path forward and knowing where your destination is, despite the different like, you know, obstacles, roadblocks, missteps, and pivots that you have to make throughout. And that there is also another, key thing we have to be sensitive to, because that's where the volatility comes. Everyone wants this linear progression. Here's my 6-month plan. I'm getting better and faster or accumulating more volume or whatever. And you see growth in training every week and you start to play that like numbers have to add up and be bigger or faster week in and week out. But that's not always the case of reality. The case of reality is navigating this volatility that might happen, right? You get sick, you get hurt, you get super stressed out, family dynamics are creating lots of stress, whatever it may be. It's understanding too, you have to find a way to keep showing up, but be adaptable so that you can keep making progress towards your, end goal or ambition, despite these kind of external or not training related roadblocks that might rear their head.
Absolutely. I think that adaptability is important, because I think a lot of times people hear consistency and they think like, oh, I've got to, nail the training exactly as it's written. But what consistency means is like being able to stay on the path and towards a trajectory that allows you to, take advantage of some of these long-term gains. So I think where my mind goes to this is how my personal running has adapted as I age. Mm-hmm. Or even when I look at the athletes that I coach who are older, how they've had to adapt as they age. And a lot of that adaptation is what allows them to like stay in the game. Because if they tried to, mimic their training of when they were 18 or 22 or 24 or what have you, what would happen is maybe they pull it off for a little bit, but eventually like their body breaks down because they don't have all those great recovery hormones going and like youth with them.
Mm-hmm.
So to stay consistent, it's about adapting that training, right? It's about saying, okay, here's the acceptance of like where I am. And instead of like trying to hit these, 9 out of 10 workouts every time, I'm going to be good with 7 out of 10s. And if I can stack 7 out of 10s, then I'm going to be able to do that for months and months and years on the line. And that's what's going to be able to give me the breakthrough performance that I'm looking for or is desired. And it's like this mentality shift that you have to use for like wisdom or experience as you age, where it's like accept the constraints and then like, balance your risk versus rewards so that you can stay in the game long enough to reap, the benefits of the training you've accumulated.
And consistency, right, it's easy. It's one of those things. It's easy to say, easy to think about, easy to articulate, but hard to do. And, it's the people who find a way to stay consistent despite a lot of like different roadblocks, as we, you know, have touched on the external ones, but more importantly, like in this day and age, the internal ones, the self-doubt, the fear, the insecurity, the impatience. And, you know, these is really, I think, what the heart of the discussion I like to kind of, you know, dive deep on is how to create a support system around yourself as a coach, and also create support systems around an athlete to ensure that they can stay consistent on this journey, on this path, and that we can set them up and position, you know, ourselves from a professional and practitioner standpoint, but also position the athletes that we're, you know, in charge of and working with to be able to blossom when their time comes. And this is, I think, the most difficult thing is understanding, quote unquote, when the time comes. It's very much seasonal. There's a seasonality element to it. And there's also a, you know, quadrennium element to it, because that's how we talk about it at, you know, when I used to be at USA Track and Field and, you know, higher level, posts, we always talk in quadrenniums, 4-year cycles, right? Because that's really the heart of the Olympic and Olympic sport movement. But also too, stepping back and you look at a lot of the like East Soviet literature and, you know, just that point of view, when you think in 4-year blocks, like 4 years of high school, 4 years of college, 4 years for Olympic cycles, right? That gives us enough time to zoom out and think about how we actually blossom over the long term versus being so concerned about the next meet or the next season or even a single year. It's really like, okay, where are we on this quadrennium journey for a person, and how do we position them and also ourselves to be able to blossom and grow and be different in a good way or have impactful change when, you know, the time is right?
Yeah, I look at it as like zooming out in perspective, right? I think one of the major things, and it's the internal, what gets in the way of you being, you know, consistent is often like it's putting out fires mode, right? Where you're like, okay, I've got the cross country season coming up. And then like, as soon as that's done, it's like, oh gosh, I better start getting ready for indoors. Oh gosh, I got to get ready for this meet and this meet. And what happens is it narrows you into this like short-term focus. And the short-term focus causes you to often like get out of that like stacking consistent work, because you're just trying to get to that next thing or that next breakthrough, which often takes you away from the long-term work that is going to allow you to you know, flourish or actually achieve that breakthrough, right? Again, going back to Lydiard, that's kind of what he said, is like, hey, let's step back, like build for a long time and get this done. And it's not to say that you have to do that. You can still run cross country and indoor and outdoor and every race imaginable. But if you don't have that like zoomed out view of how is this fitting in over the long haul, it gets in the way. And I'll give you an example, especially for high school and college athletes, is what happens is we live in a world and age of like comparison is king. So if all of a sudden you're putting out fires and you see that at first indoor meet and you had this expectation of running a PR or like running your best mile and you're nowhere close to it, what happens? Your motivation plummets.
Well, yes, exactly.
And you start like rationalizing, excusing, justifying, what have you. Your motivation goes away and you go through the like doldrums of like, oh, I'm putting in this work. Is it worth it? I've been doing these hard workouts, blah, blah, blah. And that narrowness gets in the way of like being able to say, hey, this is part of the process. I'm not supposed to light the world on fire on day one. Mm. But that's really hard. It's really hard in a world where you look around and you say, oh, you know, this team had 9 people run sub-4, you know, January first week, let's go. And like, you're looking at it like, well, I should be able to do that. But the difference is often like, you know, where are you in your journey? And I think this is why as coaches, again, we have to zoom people out. The other example I'll use, and you know, John, you and I have talked about this before and we've all been through it, but you get the freshman who comes in and wants to light the world on fire, right? Mm-hmm. They were really good in high school, maybe a state champ or one of the best in the state. And they come out and they think they're just going to like translate immediately. And then it doesn't happen. And we've all had those athletes who had the talent, but they went through that rough patch their freshman year. And then like that fire gets extinguished a little bit, right? Because they're like internally, like, what's the point, right? I'm not going to make this jump. Meanwhile, we've had others who took that, you know, zoomed out 4-year, you know, avenue or perspective where they say, okay, you know, I'm going to do my best. Freshman year, sometimes I'm going to go through some bumps, but like we're on this path towards making it to where I can contribute. And when they do that, it puts them in this long-term view where they see, okay, yeah, even if these early races aren't going well, I know what I'm trying to do. I know what I'm trying to adjust to. I know I have to make that jump, but I can't do it initially. I have to, you know, get consistent in the training. I have to get used to the higher level of racing and adjust my psychological or mental model around both training and racing and where I fit and what I'm trying to do. And because they take that zoomed out model, it allows them to not feel like, you know, oh, I'm a failure. I'm not good enough. I'm never going to make it. I'm never going to contribute. So what's the point? Instead, they see it as this is part of the journey to get to this point, and we're going to go through some ups and downs. But like how I handle that is what's going to allow me to eventually make that jump.
And this is like the, you know, when you're talking about this, Steve, this reminds me and kind of highlights the importance of using improvement through the lens of competition or competitiveness. And so what we have right in running a lot of times is this dichotomy between the gen pop. I'm just getting better for me. Yay, I'm getting improvement, which sells a lot of running shoes and running gear and we love it. And it keeps the sport funded and alive post, you know, collegially. But then two, the actual heart of competitiveness where it's like, you're in a race and somewhat it's a zero sum game and the goal is to win the thing. Like that's ultimately why we do the competition versus say the time trial or like just, you know, solo affair by yourself. The key, right, is using your improvement and contextualizing one's improvement along the lines of competitiveness and standards of excellence of competitiveness, right? So the PRs are important. The PRs matter because it shows progress, it shows results. But also too, it's the PR relative to that threshold of competitiveness and using competitiveness as how it's designed to be, which is to seek together to explore not only like one's limits within a generation or within, you know, a contextual time period of your peers, but also too, just the limits period in general. Because we all just said, hey, this is a good time and everyone shoot for this good time. And, you know, that's the standard of excellence. And there was no like, hey, actually, let's compete to win. Then what happens is you kind of get this complacency, this like, you know, generational or contextual complacency. So it's always, you know, keeping one eye on, yes, the person and your own individual progress, but also making it and connecting it to being relative to the competitive environment about which you are in, whether that be, you know, this is why we have so many different designations of competitiveness in running. We have the age categories for masters, right? 5-year increments, because it keeps that competitive juice and flame alive. That's why we have JV or varsity at the high school level. That's why we have, you know, different divisions at the high school and college level, right? It's everyone's doing the same thing. Everyone's running races. Everyone's going around these circles on these cross-country courses. But we create these designations and divisions because competitiveness is key to us, you know, exploring and to us, manifesting new levels of achievement and new levels of ability into our like, you know, psychology of striving and thriving. So a lot of times, right, in this everyone's a winner, yay for participation mindset that can happen, you know, that is very much appropriate, you know, potentially in developmental years or as people are like, you know, playing games and learning the fun of the game before it actually becomes competitive sport, before it actually becomes something where it's like, now we want to invest time, energy, and significant resources into getting better at this and seeing if we can win this sucker, then, you know, that is something that if we lose sight of that, if we lose sight of the difficulty of that and that the growth and the improvement, you know, holistically for a person and a coach rest in anchors in that, then we kind of lose sight of like what we're actually doing in practice. And one thing I remind, especially like having a big group of freshmen who, you know, are exactly where you're at, Steve, where it's like, they're kind of lost in mid-pack and races because they're used to being in the front of races. And okay, I only got to focus on being three or four guys really at a cross-country race, or two guys in, you know, a track race, or, you know, two women in this, you know, field event. And now they're just kind of like in the thick of the pack. Is understanding and just remembering, like, you're learning to walk again, and you're learning to walk again at a level that's faster, more competitive, people are more driven, and people have higher degree of support and resources available. And just how we learned how to walk, none of us remember this, right? But the fact like that all of us are walking and not defecating ourselves every minute of every day demonstrates we both learn to do hard things, you know, when we're younger, which is get potty trained and also walk. But the process was step, step, fall, cry, crawl, step, step, fall, cry, crawl, cry, 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 not try to walk for 2 days. Or, you know, just defecating on yourself in mass and being like, oh, all right, hey, still haven't figured out that when I get these signals or have this like kind of, you know, a pelvic floor control, I got to go to the bathroom or go to the toilet, right? But we all did it. It wasn't the same. And this is the hardest part too, right? Using this analogy is that it's not the same timeline for everyone. No one remembers how long it took you to learn how to walk. Steve and I don't have a record of it. Our parents didn't keep a record of it. No one did. No one said, oh, it took little Steve 42 days to learn how to potty train and little John 38. Like, no, it just kind of, you know, happened through sheer force of will. But we got to that point where we, you know, now we can move on. And this is the same thing, is just understanding part of consistency is knowing that this is a longer journey sometimes, given, you know, the environment you're in, whether it be in a scholastic setting, post-collegiate setting, master setting, and then finding that way to be adapt and work around so you can continue to thrive and hopefully position yourself. And that's really what the heart of consistency to me is positioning oneself. So at a certain point in time in a given generation, you're able to have an opportunity in front of you that you're ready for, that you can give your best effort and, you know, maybe win, maybe not win, but at least go for it and just see what you're made of.
Yeah, I think you, what you brought up there, and I think this is important, is we need to give people a shot to compete.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that's how you develop it. Just like, you know, what happens, you develop to walk because you have a shot at it. Like, you keep stumbling, you fall, you get up, you try it again, and this process takes time, right? If all of a sudden I said, John, you have to walk today, this is your only shot, you'd be screwed, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because the time frame's different. So what do we do in sport? We create different sections or avenues or paths to allow people to compete. This is why at the high school level, what do we have? We have like freshmen, JV, and like varsity. And then even with that, we have like varsity meets that are competitive, but are like league or dual meets, and then we have these giant invitationals or state meets or national championships or what have you. We have the same when we look at, you know, age categories or high school to college or college to pro to degree. We have the same when we get older and, you know, we're going the other way in terms of performance. As you mentioned, like masters, there's a reason it's every 5 years. Because every 5 years you get this boost, you're like, or every couple of years you're like, oh, I'm about to enter the next age category. I'm going to be able to be on top or
have
a shot again. Like, and that's the symptom that keeps people around and keeping going, because they're not like, oh, I'm going to set a new PR, because your PRs are long gone. Now it's this art, again, completely arbitrary, but it's this way that we allow competition to happen where it gives people a shot. And I think in track, what we often forget is that giving people a shot is how they develop the attributes to compete. And if we don't have those, then what happens is our motivation plummets. It is like if you turn 40 and you're like, or if you turn, you know, let's say 60, you're competing against everyone from 40 to 80. You're going to be like, I'm screwed if some 40-year-old dude shows up, right? Because, like, I have no shot. I can't compare. So what we have to do is we have to take advantage of these developmental pathways and like clearly enunciate them and show them like, hey, this is how we go. Why? Because it keeps people in the game long enough.
Mm-hmm.
This is what really good programs do. And if you look at whether it's NAU in college or some of the really good high school programs, such as the Woodlands High School in Texas, what they do is like, they don't say like, oh, here's our top seven and this is all that matters. Everybody sees like the pathway towards potentially getting there, right? And they see the examples of athletes who took maybe 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, sometimes 5 years at college to get to that point where you're contributing. And there is a pathway to do that that is logical, sound, and like, again, keeps people in the pipeline while developing the skills that are ready for when they show up. Again, to use NAU, it's why year after year, they'd have people who maybe it was their first year at Nationals and they'd show up,
mm-hmm.
which I'm going to tell you, and John can tell you the same, is really freaking hard to do because normally at cross country, your first year at Nationals, you just throw it into like, well, this is going to be a crapshoot because like there's nothing else really that simulates like the NCAA cross country championship that well. It's a hard thing to mimic. But what happens is if you have these pathways and like mentorship and leadership and development of competitive abilities, you have a higher shot of doing so. And that's what you see these college programs, you know, who succeed year after year despite the changing parts, do really freaking well. It's the Arkansas's of the John McDonnell era who did the same thing. The people would change, but because of the culture and the development and the competition of getting people ready to go at that point, the results would not change. They'd show up. And I think that when we look at, again, the topic of consistency, it's not just on the individual level. It's also you as the coach. You know, how do you have those pathways to create that environment where culturally, like, you create the space where, like, you know, people are going to consistently show up at the meets that matter most because they've been on this developmental pathway of getting competitive in the right ways. So that when the NCAA championship or state championship or district meet, whatever it is for you, comes up, they are prepared and ready to go.
And another thing like that's, you know, really important that, you know, kind of echoing what you talked about, in order to keep that flame or that fire, that motivation burning, you know, despite, you know, missteps, pivots and obstacles in one's journey, is that we do have to have success. We do have to have results. It doesn't feel any good to work your butt off and just constantly, you know, just not see some type of definitive positive feedback. But also the success and results has to be contextually appropriate and has to be, you know, in my opinion, an early and key ingredient of this is early. So you have to have some early success in the context that you're in to keep the motivation going. And I think of myself as a young, you know, high school runner. I was playing, I thought I was going to be a soccer or basketball guy. And then, you know, my high school coach, who was the head soccer coach, also track coach, like, hey, you should go run the JV, you know, freshman district cross country meet. They need another guy so they can have a team, you know, and score. And I said, because like, part of our conditioning, he was also like a marathoner himself. So he was like a soccer player turned marathoner. So we'd always do his run with him. It was a very sticky thing. We do his like second run with him before we even started soccer practice. It was like, all right, we're gonna go run 5 to 8 miles and then do soccer practice. And we're just like, okay, this is normal. Like, that was the start every day after school. So, I mean, some days we ran more than the cross country team and then soccer practice for like, you know, another hour, hour and a half. But so he said, okay, go run the JV freshman districts. All right. Oh, okay, coach, I'll go do that. And I got second. I got second in the city, right, at the JV or at the Frosch cross country district meet. And all of a sudden I was like, oh, maybe I can be a good runner. It wasn't, I mean, again, the better freshmen were clearly in the varsity races, but being a freshman in high school, I had no idea. But that early success, that out of the blue of saying, hey, I almost was defined as the best Frosch high school runner in the city at that time, gave me the spirit and motivation to really pursue running. And when I got stress fractures or when I got injured and I had to cross train the pool for 6 weeks, right? I knew like I was one of the, you know, with that early, success, I knew I was one of the better runners, or I thought, at least in my mind, I was one of the better or best runners in the city. And then that allowed me to dream to be, try to become one of the best runners in the state, right? And then with that, okay, then I go to college and then it's like, okay, well now I want to play this game all over again, be one of the best, you know, or better runners in the conference, right? And then toward, if you do that, then the nation, and I topped off like at the conference being competitive, but not, you know, the best. But it was like, that was the motivator the whole time. And if I didn't have that early success, if I didn't have that early efficacy and positive result of performance and proof of performance, I don't think I would have been able to endure the 6 stress fractures I had in the next like 6 years, right? And like play that game and cross train like crazy and be on the bike or the pool and, you know, be able to go through that. So we have to understand, too, you do have to position people in some way to give them contextual positive results for the context they're in. So like for us, a lot of what we do with our freshmen here at Portland State is really highlight the freshman all-time top 10 list, or like say the school records that might be a little softer on the untraditional distances, just so it's like, hey, let's compete at these, untraditional distances indoors, the K, the 6, 100, whatever, and give you a sense of identity and efficacy, or, position yourself relative to the all-time freshman top 10 marks. So you see, oh, hey, you're one of the best all-time who's ever been here. So we're giving you efficacy on that level. And then hopefully that positions you to then get more competitive at the Big Sky level. And if you're more competitive at the Big Sky level because of, you know, the schools in our conference, then you're one of the more competitive people in the nation. It's not rocket science, right? But that early success is key. And if we don't have that anchor successful moment in that is contextually appropriate, then consistency does get real hard. And I've seen a lot of athletes who don't have that early success fall victim to burnout or complacency or, you know, defeatism, because they don't have that like driving motivation or force because they don't have that anchor early success.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the key there, and this is like the reminder for us as coaches who have been in it for a long time, is we tend to see success narrowly. But when you're young and developing, whether that's high school or college freshman, you're kind of clueless on it. Meaning, like, you know, when Little John was running that freshman high school thing, he didn't know how fast or slow he was, right?
Yeah, no clue.
No idea. And I remember the same when I ran the freshman division of cross country, my first cross country meet in high school. I barely outkicked another athlete and won the meet. And I thought, holy crap, this is great. I won something, even though it was like the freshman division of like a, you know, 6-team meet. It had meaning. It like elevated. And then we gradually increased those stepping stones or ramps. And I think as coaches, we often see it as like this hierarchy of like, well, that's not that fast. And it might not be in the grand scheme of things, but you've got to build that ladder to bridge that gap. And like utilizing whether it's freshman meets or low key meets, or as you did, like the record book, I would do the same. When I was at Houston, man, I pulled out all the records and even like looked back and found them, because at the time we didn't have a super long list, and like found the top 10 list and then celebrated it just so I could say like, oh, you made it, you know, top 10 on the all time 1K list. And you don't say like, you know, how many times has anybody run a 1K? No. You say like, hey, you're number 7 on the 1K list of all time history. We've been running track since 19, whatever. Mm. And like what that does is it gives that almost that rope where someone says like, oh, I can see it. I can go up the next rung. I can move up. And the same when it came to, you know, we would give people avenues. What's goal number one, you know, for us, like indoors or outdoors, is we'd say, hey,
you know, I forget what it was exactly, but whatever, 32 people can compete at the indoor championship, right?
Mm.
Our first goal is be one of those 32. How do you be one of those 32? Well, you generally put yourself in the top, you know, 10 list in the conference or whatever it is for an event.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the list. How do we get up to that spot? And then it's like, okay, you know, once we're in that top 32, then it's like, okay, well, how do we move to the scoring? You know, give ourselves a shot at the scoring or the final or whatever it is. Well, you have different avenues to like kind of give people a shot to move through that in different ways. And, you know, sometimes I'd pull an athlete aside and give them a spot where they might not be able to make it at that level yet. But I'd say, hey, you know what? Our top guys or gals are all running open events. Guess what that means? Is if you get your time down, like maybe you're the 800 leg on that DMR.
Mm-hmm.
Because that way I can save our 150 or 149 guy to run the 800 fresh. And if you can run 151, maybe you wouldn't make the final in the 800. But like if you were going to run 151 on the relay leg of the DMR versus other people's, you know, tired legs, that's going to be a big asset for us. So can we get you to that level, which is just a little bit more manageable or what have you? And I think that's, again, what that allows us is to keep people in the game, to keep them motivated, to stoke those fires, to bridge those gaps, which gives them the motivation and incentive to like put in the consistent work because there is hope for like contributing, reaching success, like doing something meaningful.
And that's like another core ingredient of consistency is progression, but a very specific type of progression, relational progression. So we have narcissistic progression, which is me versus me, which only goes so far. You getting better in kind of a vacuum is nice, but it doesn't really give that spark, right? It doesn't keep that fire burning warm. Relational progression, as we were, you know, been talking about here, that's the key. We are relational creatures. So this is why we create all these games that are relational to whether it's all time for people who've gone to a school or all time for people in a certain conference and a collection of schools. Like it, if you zoom out, right, it's all really a random assortment. I mean, like, all right, why are we in this conference? I don't know, football, basketball, whatever. Like, we're reshuffling here, you know, at the high school level. So we have more football playoff games. Like, you know, we have six divisions in Oregon, like six. We're not that populous of a state, and yet we have as many divisions as like California and Texas. It blows my mind, right? But really, it's relational progression. And so that's another core thing that as a coach and as an athlete, you have to have a pulse on is how to continue to build that runway and build that bridge from where one is now to where they could be in the relational zeitgeist. And without that, like, you know, as the kids today say, you're cooked. Like, it becomes really stale and it becomes really trite. And that was a very interesting thing, you know, during our era and being around different elite runners, right? Like in milers, like, you know, Leo Manzano, Alan Webb, or, you know, Andrew Weeding, you know, guys who Olympic medalists, American record holders, Olympians, they didn't like training. They didn't like it. They weren't like, oh, I love training. Like even Chris Zelensky, right? I talked to him about this there, you know, a couple months ago. He said, I really didn't like training. I like winning. And I knew that in order to win, I had to train. Or when Alan at the end of his career stopped winning, he always got really hard to train because I didn't feel like I was doing anything special anymore. Every time, like when I was training, I felt like I was doing something special because it set me up to do something, you know, special on the track and do something that like, you know, break a record or something that's never been done in a certain way. And that's really what drove him. Same thing, like if you look at Andrew Weeding's training logs, I mean, they're the most unimpressive, random hodgepodge workouts I've ever seen, right? Like there was always something going on, always some injuries managing, or always like this hesitancy there. And that's fine because he's kind of like Allen Iverson, right? We're talking about practice. I'll give you 110% in a game or the race, right? And when it came time to deliver, he would be there, you know, when you as a collegiate or professional. So it's understanding too that part of the heart of consistency and adaptability is also this contextual progress. And knowing that, having coached a lot of people, like I see it, there's people who love to train and they don't like to race. And there's people who hate to train and love to race. And then there's other people who fall at different points in that spectrum. But at the end of the day, that's where the real growth happens, is in competition, the preparation for competition, and then the act of competition, and then the learnings from competition, the motivations from competition. And the other key thing as a coach is the better coach you are, and I didn't learn this until later in my coaching career, means you're able to motivate and inspire and use defeats in competition as a positive catalyst for improved progression and consistency. And if you cannot use the defeats of competition or frame them in a way to your athlete that spurs that motivation for progression and consistency and training and motivation, you really have to look at what your coaching is about, because that's a guarantee that you're always going to have those moments. And those are the key teachable moments that really can make or break an athlete's season and also sometimes their career.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's like our job, again, coming back to it, our job as coaches is like perspective of how to do this. And I think too often what happens is, you know, we're setting athletes up for like this false ideal of like, I'm always going to be motivated. Everything's going to go great. I'm going to progress at all times. Like I should enjoy all the training and showing up. And it's like, no, no, wait a minute. Sometimes it's just going to suck. You know, like I would always set the stage for my athletes at Houston, or before when I was coaching high school kids, because we were training in Houston, I'd say, look, here's the deal. Here's how it's going to go. You're going to come off your track season break. It's going to, depending on when your season ends, it's going to be May or June. And you're going to start training again. And because you're training in Texas, it's going to be god awful and absolutely miserable. And you're going to sit there and be like, holy crap, I'm so out of shape. This is really hard running 7-minute pace all day. Like I'm sweating my ass off. Every day feels like it sucks. And I'm supposed to be building this mileage. And I tell them, it's going to suck. But if you stick at it for a couple weeks or a month, at some point, I guarantee you, because this happens all the time, it happened to me and it happens to everyone as coach, one day you're going to wake up and it's going to suck a little bit less. And it's not going to be easy. It's not going to feel great because it's still a billion degrees out with a 1,000,000% humidity. Mm-hmm. But all of a sudden you're going to be like, I can do this. I'm all right. My legs don't feel like trash all the time. It, the only way you get to that point is if you just say, hey, training's going to kind of suck for a while, and accept it. And I think often what happens is we frame our expectations incorrectly. And we tell people like, you know, you're going to enjoy this all the time. Like once you get in shape, the workout's going to come easy, all of that. And it's just, it's not true, right? I remember when training with Alan, like there were many days where I'd just be like, do I really want to go spend 4 hours this morning at the track?
Yeah.
Not particularly, but it's what you do. Mm. It's the brushing your teeth phenomenon, right? You show up to brush your teeth. And I think that sometimes we have to reframe from like thinking like, this has got to feel perfect and good and motivated and wanted, to know I've just got to take the actions. And if I take the actions, the motivation will follow at some point.
And that, you know, the key there, right, is urgency. Urgency, as I define it, is do it now. Do it now. Do it now. Because if you don't do it now, if you don't have urgency, if you don't have motivation, if you don't, you know, have that aura around you, as the, you know, as we say today, then you don't have consistency. So, I know it was a good example. Like yesterday we had, you know, a track meet, a little throws event at our place in partnership with the University of Portland, and kind of a mini meet that we do. And so we set it up in the morning. The athletes threw. It was great. It was a lot of fun. And, you know, my wife, who's training for like the U.S. Master Indoor Champs and World Champs and stuff, right? She's like, I got to go for my run. And I said, yeah, I get it. So we got done with it. And she's like, I got to do it now. And if I don't do it now, then I'm going to eat lunch and I'm going to like lay on the couch. And then I'm not going to want to do it because I'm tired from helping, you know, set up, break down, and officiate the meet. So I said, great. And so she went out and she did it now. And sometimes, like, it's like Kipchoge talks about, right? You just got to get out the door. Like, you just got to get the juices going. And, you know, all those little hacks you read about where it's like, pack your stuff the night before, have everything set up, like, you know, reduce the friction costs as best you can so that action is taken. And as a coach too, it's the same thing. Like, we're always trying to like create an environment that reduces the friction cost so that it creates a situation in place where consistency is the default. And this is why it's so easy to do in college, right? We have practice times. You know, I send out the workouts for the week, you know, on Sunday night. Here's the next 7 days of training, everybody. We don't even have to think about it. Instead of like, hey, what are we doing today? What are we doing today? What are we doing today? When are we doing it? Where are we doing it? Here's what time we're meeting. Here's where we're going. Here's the environment we're going to train in. Here's the stuff you need. Here's the gear you need, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it gets tough to do when you don't have a big group around you like you do in the scholastic environment. I mean, that's what every post-collegiate discovers really quickly, or anyone training on their own. It's like, holy, I have all this freedom and I can go at whatever time I want. And yay, I don't have to do, And then you realize, like, actually, no, that kind of those constraints, those of class and practice time and et cetera, those constraints were actually anchor ingredients to having you being consistent and blossom. And that's why you see a lot of post-collegiates, right? They'll get signed and do whatever. And then they'll actually like have a little downswing in performance for a year or two. And everyone's like, what's wrong with them? Blah, 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 blah. It's like they went from a really structured environment for about 8 to 10 years in this classic setting in the American, you know, track and field and running world to now this very loosey-goosey and unstructured environment in the professional world where it's like, hey, you're on your own for everything for the most part. And you just see your coach at like the 2 or 3 workouts a week. And that's really it. That's the only time you really see your coach, unless you need to have a meeting and talk about bigger things or this or that in the post-collegiate world. And it's easy and tough coaching post-collegiates and being a post-collegiate because, yeah, you only see them on those days and they're usually ready to go, but they have to be so internally motivated and self-driven every single day, without necessarily that structure of support around them and that density of support of people that, again, it can get real challenging. So another part of that consistency puzzle is your support structure in your environment.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's what we're getting at here is, like, as a coach, if I was to summarize everything that we're talking about, it's like consistency is king, but those are simple words. How do you do that? You create the structure environment. It comes back to the good high school teams, the NAUs, the other successful programs, even at the elite or post-collegiate level. They create the environment where it is easier to be consistent. The environment invites the action. The environment invites you showing up and putting in the work in the right way. The environment invites, like, having pathways to competitiveness and learning and growing and developing. And that's on us as coaches to do it. Are we making it easy to brush our teeth because the toothbrush is sitting on our sink, you know, with the toothpaste right next to it? Or we make it hard where maybe we have to go into the other room, into a closet, and go, you know, on a rummage for our toothbrush and toothpaste. I guarantee you, if we make it hard, we're not brushing our teeth as much. Mm-hmm. And although that's a simplistic, you know, example, it's the truth in what we're doing as coaching. It's like we need to create the environment around us that gives those athletes the opportunity to get on the consistent train.
And this is where, you know, the ecological design or ecological philosophy comes, you know, into play, is exactly this, which says the environment invites, is an invitation to do or not do something. So part of the process, right, is saying when you think about how to construct a training plan, it's also in a progression for an athlete. It's also how to construct the right environment so that it happens. And for example, everyone likes to talk about, oh, individualized training. But in the context of a team dynamic or in a group atmosphere, that's impossible to do individualized training. And it's probably also not as productive because if Johnny, Timmy, Susie, you know, Christina, and Sarah all have different workouts because they all have different quote unquote volumes or intensities, right? and they're all on their own on the track, but running at the same time, it doesn't really feel like we're in sync with each other. It doesn't really feel like we're supporting each other. And that relational component, right? That relational progressive component isn't there. And that's really valuable because on our team, we have kind of a wide spectrum of student athletes, say in the middle distance and distance, but there's some workouts that are more speed oriented and they know, oh, hey, these guys are the fast guys. If I can keep close to them, I can get faster. And then other workouts are more endurance oriented. Right. And these guys are the hammer hogs. Right. And if I can stay in the speed guys, if they can stay close to those guys for a certain, duration of a rep, they know they're getting better. And so everyone then has like their turn in practice about, to be the one like being pursued or pursuing. And then too, we kind of structure where it's like, hey, all right, if we're doing, say, a simple workout where it might be like a breakdown, right? Some type of breakdown where could be a 1K breakdown, so 500, 300, 200. Here's the paces. Here's what we want to do. Okay, hey, you have the speed, but you don't have like the volume of training behind you. So instead of doing 5-3-2, how about you do, 4-2-2 or something like that. So within the context of the workout construction, making it so there can be partnership and inclusion, and contextual progression, consistency with your peers, but also too, not overcooking you by doing, all right, just a little too much volume of intensity, that's going to make it so this calf will blow up, or you're going to go to straight acidosis after one set or what have you. That type of pivoting and, audible calling and type of individualization within the context of the team environment or in the context of the team workout, that's really how we get better. Because we know, right, that with all the training groups, the explosion of the training groups in the mid-2010s or in early 2010s that happened, and then American distance running getting significantly better because of the explosion in these post-collegiate training groups we had, we know that that's the key. That's the key, is others, is those around you. And I was, I forget who I was talking to, but you realize as a coach, right, that you're not necessarily the key catalyst that makes people or group great. It's the way you create an environment and the people you invite and the people you position to blossom and where they are in their journey and who they are, from a personality standpoint. If they're already this fast or already this good or already this motivated, but it becomes positively infectious to everyone else, that kind of manipulation of the environment and that kind of orchestration, that's really the heart of coaching, especially in a group setting. And when you can do that and do that well and be that orchestrator for everything, and then you can just sit back, like I could sit back the other day, I came to the track for our Tuesday workout for our guys. And, with that, it was like there was some administrative stuff I had to focus in on at, the school. So I couldn't get to the track in time for the workout. So I was 45 minutes late. So I missed, the warm up. I missed I caught them right at the end of activation, and we did a quick check-in. And then I was still dealing with some other administrative things that I had to make, get that were time sensitive that had to get done right then, right there. And the guys just like were basically just going on the track, doing the workout, and didn't need me to call any splits, didn't need me at all. And I was just like looking over, and I go, that's a beautiful sight to see. They're autonomous, they're motivating each other, and they're all getting better collectively. Like that's a cultural W. Like when your event coach is the head coach, and sometimes you have to put the head coach hat on and it compromises the event coach duties. Seeing that happen though, and knowing, hey, those guys are all right, they take care of themselves, they can do it. Like that's a big sign we're on the right path. And that demonstrates how consistency in action and also that communal and relational support.
Absolutely. I couldn't have summed it up better, John. I think that's what it's getting at. And that's why consistency is king, and how to set up the environment that creates it where people are invited to do so is what it's all about. If you enjoyed this podcast, well, thanks for listening. Don't forget, check out the Running Scholar Program. We've got all sorts of good stuff there, dropping new courses like crazy and having our monthly Zoom talks. So check that out. The link is in the show notes. Until next time, everybody, guess what? We're going to be consistent. We're going to keep showing up for the podcasts. Hopefully you do too.
Like we've been doing for 10 years, bro. 10 years.
That's been a decade. That's the greatness. So join us for another 10 years.
Join us for another 10 years. Thanks for those who have been OGs from day one. We appreciate y'all.